All I Want for Christmas is a movie ticket. Today, Thursday, December 25th. This is The World. After a last-minute decision by Sony to release it, crowds line up to see the controversial new film, The Interview.
When it was banned, you know, it became a patriotic imperative to come see it.
And Christmas for The Daily Show's Asif Manvi. As kids, he and his sister were intent on celebrating the holiday, in spite of his parents' indifference.
But because we were Muslim, it was sort of like, we don't really celebrate that, you know. But Jesus is in the Quran, so probably it's okay to celebrate his birth.
And we've got an Oxford a cappella band that combines Mariah Carey with even more Christmas camp.
All I want for Christmas is you.
That's ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is your Christmas Day edition of The World. On again, off again, threats, accusations, and finally a happy ending. Could be the treatment for a romantic comedy, but it's not. It's the rollout of The Interview, the film starring Seth Rogen and James Franco, which opened in limited release across the U.S. today. Reporter Sydney Beveridge is outside the Williamsburg Cinemas in Brooklyn, a few hours south of us in New York City. It's one of the few theaters showing The Interview today. Sydney, hello. Is the theater taking any security precautions?
Hello. Well, I spoke briefly to the manager, and he said they're just using their normal security, just sort of searching people's bags on their way into the theater and if they notice any suspicious activity. But otherwise, just a normal day.
Yeah. And so how busy was it? A lot of people showing up?
Yeah, there was definitely, starting 40, 45 minutes before the show, a pretty steady trickle of people picking up their tickets or getting tickets from the door. When I first got there, there were still tickets available, but by the time they got close to showtime, the show did indeed sell out.
Yeah, I've been hearing about several sellout theaters around the country. Why did people tell you they were there? Curiosity? They actually thought it was going to be a really great film? Why?
I will say there definitely seemed to be a lot of Seth Rogen fans living in Williamsburg. So a lot of people, I think, intended to see the movie anyway, maybe not necessarily on Christmas Day. But one person sort of framed it as a patriotic one of the things that motivated them to come out.
Well, we wanted to see it in part because, you know, we've liked Seth Rogen movies in the past, but when it was banned, you know, it became a patriotic imperative to come see it. So we felt, you need to do it. So we're glad it sold out.
And I think other people definitely referenced that as well, that they sort of, I think, took some pride in the fact that the movie was able to make it to the theaters after all. Another person, he referenced Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator and how when that movie came out, it was seen as so controversial in its day.
When Chaplin released The Dictator, it was in the midst of World War II, and he was clearly making fun of Hitler, and the movie was a success. The movie was brilliant. It was funny and smart. And, you know, this doesn't have the same caliber, but I think it's sad that in a more modern way, now we're scared and we cave, and we're supposed to be not scared of anything, especially not in a movie or, you know, show or anything.
The fact that this movie was able to, you know, make it to the theaters and, you know, surmount this censorship and these threats, you know, they saw as a real achievement and something that they wanted to kind of be a part of.
So it's amazing the kind of diverse range of opinion on whether this is a good movie or a bad movie. Somebody I follow on Facebook yesterday said it was the best $5.99 they ever spent on YouTube. First $5.99 they ever spent on YouTube. Other people say it's the worst thing they've ever seen in their life. Have you seen it?
I have not. Though, actually, there was one gentleman I ran into. He was actually there to see another movie, but he'd watched The Interview the night before. He said it was good. He said he was glad he watched it. Maybe the fact that it's a few bucks cheaper than the theater ticket helped. But it's funny. A lot of people, I think, did say they didn't necessarily have the highest expectations for it, but they expected to be entertained enough to make it worthwhile.
Yeah, so when are you getting your ticket, Sydney?
Maybe I should try and line up for the next show. We'll have to see. Though, I don't know, I figure perhaps I should be quiet about my activities. I don't know who's listening to this.
Sydney, a Merry Christmas to you, and thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Yes, if Christmas in America feels different this year, blame it all on this movie about a fictitious assassination plot. Christmas Day continued apace, though, in many places around the world, like Rome, where Pope Francis delivered his traditional Christmas Day blessing from St. Peter's Square at the Vatican.
I nostri fratelli e sorelle dell'Iraq e della Siria.
I ask him, the Savior of the world, to look upon our brothers and sisters in Iraq and Syria, who for too long now have suffered the effects of ongoing conflict, and who, together with those belonging to other ethnic and religious groups, are suffering a brutal persecution.
These are dark times for many people in the Middle East. Christians are feeling especially vulnerable. The region is home to the oldest Christian communities in the world, but that home is shrinking fast. In the past few months, extremists from the so-called Islamic State have forced tens of thousands of Iraqi Christians to flee. Our BBC colleague Yolan Nell met some families spending their first Christmas as refugees in Jordan.
A choir of Iraqi Christians sings for an audience of Iraqi Christians. But we're in the Jordanian capital, Amman. And this year, many of the hundreds attending this service aren't just coming to churches to celebrate Christmas. They've been forced to live in them too. Leila Matouche, a mother of two, is helping to prepare breakfast in this communal kitchen at the Marjal Hammam Church. She's from Mosul, like everyone staying here. In the summer, they fled when Islamic State militants took over their city. I can't describe how terrified I was, Leila tells me. These extremists don't act like human beings. They chop people's heads off. We left behind our home, our business, our whole existence. We took our girls and ran. And as they sit down to eat, her husband, Dia, says this will be a humble Christmas. Back in Iraq, you'd feel joyful at this time, he says. But now our churches are empty. They've been converted to mosques. Militants are living in our houses. More than 5,000 Christians from Iraq have arrived in Jordan in recent months. Charities do what they can to help, but there are feelings of despair. Most of the refugees can't see any way they'll be able to go home anytime soon. Earlier this year, Ranin celebrated her engagement in Mosul. But now she's getting married in Amman. She smiles as her mum and her aunt sing and dance for her. But this wedding day is bittersweet. It's brought loved ones together, but only briefly. As he waits for his bride, the groom Saif tells me he doesn't expect to return to Iraq.
I don't think I'll go back. I want to travel overseas to develop myself and bring up a family, because I don't have a future in Iraq. There are other countries where they know about human rights. With all my respect to Arab countries, they treat people better there. It's better to build a future there.
And the couple getting married aren't alone in wanting to start a new life elsewhere. Hundreds of thousands of Christians have emigrated in recent years. The trend worries church leaders like Father Nabil Haddad here in Jordan.
It's very important for Christianity to find and to have followers of Jesus Christ in this part of the world, in this region. This is the birthplace of Christianity. It's so important that we preserve the living stones. We are the living stones. We carry the message of love, the message of Christianity.
Back at the Iraqi choral service, the Christmas message is about peace and hope. But right now, in the Middle East, there's a shortage of both.
Yolan Nell reporting from Amman in Jordan. Here's a bit of advice on this Christmas day. When there's a lot of food around you in this land of plenty, just taste a bit of it all. You'll fill up fast, trust me. That's actually a pro tip from food writer Steve Dolinsky. He's an old friend of mine and the world's, and Steve knows that if you're making a living writing about food, you should just not eat everything you're served. Steve shared that with me recently when he came to Boston. You see, Steve lives in Chicago, but he knows Boston's food better than I do. So I told Steve my idea. I pick three of Boston's biggest immigration trends, and he takes me to the best little food joints those immigrants have produced. We've got one of the largest Armenian communities in the U.S., as well as a long history of arrivals from Brazil and Vietnam. So today on The World, we offer you a three-course meal, three outings to local joints. The first one, just a couple of minutes away from where I'm talking now, the Armenian Market and Bakery in the neighborhood of Watertown, which has the third largest Armenian community in the country. We pulled up to a nondescript brick building with a bright yellow awning and the words Armenian Pizza. That's where we met this guy.
I'm Mark Sinar from Armenian Market and Bakery.
Mark Sinar is the son of the owner.
So we have savory treats here. They're called bochas. They're all handmade dough made here directly from Armenian Market and Bakery, stuffed with cheese. One is potato, one is ground beef, and the other is spinach and cheese. We do offer boiled eggs as well. They come in spinach and cheese, as well as a soubrette egg, which is a boiled filled dough, very similar to a lasagna. And we have a cheese variety as well as spinach and cheese variety of those as well.
And how many of these kind of innovations came about here in the United States, and how many of these are like exact reproductions of pastries or kind of things you would have in the old country?
So nothing comes from the United States. All of this tradition has come from the Middle East.
So, Steve, tell me what you got here.
All right, so got a couple of things. We got the bocha, which I had never seen before. This is their homemade dough. It looks kind of like an empanada,
yeah,
with a little bit of nigella seed on top of it.
This is a bit of what?
Nigella seed. It's like a little black seed from India. Mm. This is feta cheese inside with a little bit of herbs.
Wow.
So here, I'll give you half of that.
Well,
let's go ahead.
Mm. I don't want to get the cheese on the baklava, so let's move that out of the way.
The cheese is nice and salty, which I love. This just like reminds me of Greek food, really, isn't it? And this is the cool thing about Armenian food. Because it's tucked away on that sort of eastern edge of Turkey, you've got influences from Syria, Lebanon, but also Russia on the other side. So like you have these pastries, but there's that cheese inside, which is almost, you know, which is Greek, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then in front of us is lahmacun, Armenian pizza, ground lamb, peppers, tomatoes. Now, it comes on a little plate with two lemons, so I'm going to squeeze some lemon on. And this is what I had been taught at another restaurant in Chicago. You don't just eat it like this, you roll it up. And so now I've got like a little Armenian pizza roll-up, this lahmacun.
Mm.
Makes it more handheld. Delicious. Delicious dough.
This is good.
They clearly, I mean...
This is a good one.
The bakery sign out front is not just for show. They make pretty much everything here. They make all their phyllo for their baklava.
Mm.
But for this one, this is just a savory... It's a savory pie. It's a roll-up. But, man, this tastes like that part of the world.
Hmm.
Well, that's a good combo.
Fantastic. All right. Way to start things off.
Much more to taste later. You can see photos from my Boston food adventure with Steve Dolinsky at PRI.org. And speaking of food, it's often a big part of Christmas traditions, from the big family meal to what you leave out for Santa. But it can get a little complicated for immigrant kids whose families don't celebrate Christmas.
When I was little, I used to put out cookies and milk, thinking that Santa would come and that would, like, you know, bring me presents. But Santa never came, and my mom would get angry because she said, you know, leaving out cookies like that will attract ants. So she'll just, like, put it away.
That's also coming up, a look at building Christmas traditions in new American families. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Today in her annual Christmas broadcast, Queen Elizabeth II praised medical workers fighting the Ebola epidemic. She hailed the selflessness of aid workers who have gone abroad to help victims. We want to focus on one of those aid workers for the next few minutes. He's an MD named John Wright. He joined a team of British medics setting up a treatment center in a remote part of Sierra Leone, a town called Moyamba. Dr. Wright kept an audio diary for the BBC of what he did while he was there. Listen to this.
Well, I've had my first day in Freetown, and the size of this task is becoming rapidly clear. There's a team of six of us, and we've got about 3 weeks to basically set up and run a hospital in the middle of the African bush. And it all feels quite daunting, really.
We've also got to get a lab. So we really need facilities that can diagnose Ebola. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to build an Ebola treatment center. It will just become full of patients with malaria and pneumonia and TB. We've got to get staff. We've got to get a fully functioning mini hospital up with doctors, nurses, healthcare assistants, cooks, cleaners, drivers. And that involves working out how many doctors and nurses we're going to need to cover 24/7 clinical care, but also making sure that we've got the right proportion of national and international staff. We don't want this to be some sort of European colonial descent into Moyamba. It's got to be done in partnership with the Sierra Leoneans.
For catch Ebola, if we don't wash the hand with soap and water, fast one. After, we then use the toilet and before then touch anything from it.
I've become acculturated to the daily routines of infection control. The ritual hand washing with chlorinated water at every checkpoint and every time you go in and out of a building. The fever checks done with cheap Chinese laser thermometers, which I have a suspicion aren't particularly accurate. Last night when I was walking back through Moyamba, it was dusk, and I was passing pedestrians along the red earthen road. And a child who was passing grabbed my hand. It was a sign of affection, a child's curiosity. And at first, I felt a warmth, a feeling of being touched by another human being. Nobody's touched my hand for 2 weeks now. But within a couple of seconds, I'm thinking, I don't know who that child is. Did the hand seem warm? Did it seem feverish? And then I spend the rest of the 10 minutes walking back to the guest house, keeping my hand at a distance from me. And when I get back, I'm all Lady Macbeth, washing, just in case. Conspiracy theories swirl around every society, but never more than rural African ones. When I was working in southern Africa in the 1990s, at the start of the HIV epidemic, the local young men were adamant that AIDS was some sort of pro-celibacy conspiracy. American invention to discourage sex was their take on the acronym. So it's not surprising that crazy myths and rumours about our Ebola hospital have already started. At this morning's command and control meeting, we're informed that local people have been told that the new hospital has been built to deliberately infect people with Ebola. Apparently, a white man has been seen at the Ebola hospital giving people Ebola injections. I decided that it was probably time for some community engagement to quash the conspiracies, so off I go to Moyamba radio station.
That's a tricky question. It's very difficult to tell. We can't second guess what the epidemic's going to be and what it's going to do. We know that it's still rising. We know that Sierra Leone is...
I'm at the Moyamba Holding Centre, where for the last 5 months, nurses have been looking after patients with Ebola, suspected of Ebola. It's a ramshackle shed on the edge of town, a place that when you talk to the locals generates great fear, because they see this as the place where Ebola patients are kept, and there's a great nervousness about it. And myself, I'm pretty nervous about coming here because having built our super high standards at the Ebola Treatment Center, this is very much low tech in comparison. Everything's just very simple, pieces of plastic, corrugated iron roof, very simple chlorine water pools. And I'm with Alfred, who's been the nurse. He saw the first patient with Ebola in Moyamba back in April, was that, Alfred?
Yeah, I'm Alfred S. Kamara, in charge of the holding center, Moyamba.
And you've done this with a small team of nurses. We've got this fantastic treatment center down the road with hundreds of staff and fantastic technology, but you've been keeping this going for 5 months, looking after local people. Have you been scared yourself, Alfred?
Oh, yes, of course. When it started at first, you know, I became feared because of, you know, the infection rate, especially on our bosses, when we heard of our most prominent Dr. Khan. The death of Dr. Khan pissed me off. But so far, according to the workshops conducted, as long as you have your full PPE and you do things professionally, it came to my mind that you are safe.
And have you, over half the patients that you've had here have had turned out to have Ebola? Have you seen many people die from Ebola in this holding center?
Yes, yes. We have been death rates at the holding center because others do come in very, very, very late after developing all the signs and symptoms.
Okay, will you come and work for us, Alfred? We need your expertise.
Oh, yes, I'm ready to work with you.
Well, I look forward to being your student, Alfred.
No, I would like to be a student of yours and not you.
That was truly remarkable and deeply humbling. Alfred and his team of three nurses and two hygienists have been fighting this battle against Ebola since the start of August. They've seen 220 patients, 120 of them with Ebola, and been using this facility, which is a converted cattle shed. A few strips of plastic sheeting as tents out the back, a homemade incinerator. It's remarkable. And here we come with our fleet of 4x4s, build this million-pound Ebola treatment centre, employ 200 staff. 6 months late, they must be thinking, where did these guys come from? Alfred and his team really are the true heroes of this battle against Ebola.
That was the audio diary of Dr. John Wright, who's helping fight the Ebola epidemic in Sierra Leone. On Christmas Day, you're listening to The World.
This podcast is supported in part by contributions from individuals like you. As we close out this calendar year, please consider a gift to PRI and help us to keep on top of the stories that you care about. Our mission is to create a more informed, engaged world. Won't you join us? Please visit PRI.org/give and support PRI today.
I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, Daily Show comedian Asif Mandvi describes the pitfalls of being a Muslim at Christmas.
I do remember my parents getting invited to their neighbors and being offered like Bailey's Irish cream, and then my mother not knowing that it was alcohol, and she drank it and was kind of like, this is delicious.
The holidays, a time of discovery, coming up on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's hard to look around today and not see Christmas everywhere. But what if Christmas is not part of your tradition? That's the case for many immigrants in the U.S., including Muslim actor and comedian Asif Mandvi. You might know him as a regular on The Daily Show, and I talked to him recently about his new book called No Lands Man. Yes, you heard the title right. In that book, Asif, you share stories about growing up in the UK, so you must have seen your fair share of traditional Christmas. But your family is Indian and Muslim. Did they feel compelled to participate in any of that stuff?
Well, you know, I don't think my parents really knew how to celebrate Christmas when we first got to the UK. You know, we didn't have a Christmas tree for, like, I think the first 10 years or something. It was sort of like my parents would just hide gifts behind the sofa. It wasn't part of our upbringing. It wasn't part of their upbringing. And so they didn't quite know all the traditions and stuff.
And like good kids who anticipate that Christmas Day, were you hunting around for the presents and trying to get them open?
You know, it just became really about just giving us gifts. And so they celebrated Christmas because we wanted to celebrate. Me and my sister wanted to celebrate Christmas, you know. So right. And all of our friends in school were doing it. And so it became kind of the holiday of just like getting gifts. So I do remember the sort of, you know, waking up Christmas morning and opening gifts, which were often just wrapped in brown paper or, you know, not wrapped at all sometimes, just hidden behind the sofa.
You talk in No Land's Man about your dad being an occasional source of embarrassment for you. What did he really get wrong about Christmas?
I don't think I think they understood what it was about. I think my parents were completely like, oh, it's, you know, the birth of Jesus. And, you know, but because we were Muslim, it was sort of like, we don't really celebrate that, you know, but we do believe in Jesus. And so I guess it's okay. You know, they kind of rationalize this sort of thing of like, I mean, Jesus is in the Quran, so probably it's okay to celebrate his birth. But I do remember my parents like getting invited to their neighbors' Christmas parties and being offered like Bailey's Irish cream. And then my mother not knowing that it was alcohol, and she drank it and was kind of like, this is delicious. You know, next thing you know, she's drunk and she's never been drunk before. And so and now she's calling my father darling, which is something that, you know, Indian parents never do.
Is there one Christmas at the Manvi household that you kind of really remember as being kind of, this is a nice mix of two traditions, or one that you remember that was just completely off the rails?
Well, we have a funny Christmas tradition in our home, which is a little bit unorthodox and a little bit odd, I guess. When we first came to America, my parents, you know, didn't have a lot of money, and they were sort of like, they were kind of struggling for a while. We had moved from England to the U.S. and my dad was starting a new business. And so that first Christmas, they couldn't really buy us a lot of gifts. And this sounds very sort of Dickensian, but they basically, my dad got us each one gift. And then, you know, in order to pad it out, he wrapped other things in like Christmas, you know, wrapping. And so I remember like opening one of the gifts that we got, and me and my sister, and we both had like Planters peanuts. And he had wrapped a bottle of Planters peanuts as a gift, and a little bit like a joke, but kind of also because they didn't really have a lot of gift. So now in our home, like every year, one of the gifts is a wrapped up bottle of Planters peanuts.
Well, you know, it's a sweet reminder that it is the thought that counts, right?
Right, exactly. Yes, you know, and I think they actually said that.
So yours is kind of a story, the Christmas story anyway, of celebrating this tradition through, you know, a different set of lenses. What about your own, you know, Muslim holidays? And I know you're not the poster child for Islam, but still, how do you celebrate things like Eid?
Not very well, really, because most of the time, you know, I'm not really with my family. I, you know, they live down in Florida and stuff. So, you know, Eid is something that for many years my parents would call and be like, hey, it's Eid tomorrow. Like, you know, just, you know, I would celebrate just by virtually like a phone call.
Asif Manvi, great to meet you. Thank you for the interview.
Thank you.
And here's another take on the holidays from Tam Dong. She's from Los Angeles and lives in Boston, but her parents are Vietnamese and Buddhist. And like Asif Manvi, Dong's relationship with Christmas really says a lot about her relationship with her parents.
My very first memory of Christmas is being in elementary school and learning about Santa and the reindeers and Rudolph. But when I came home and tried to talk to my family about it, they had no idea what I was talking about. They said it was just a holiday, and we're a Vietnamese family, and so Vietnamese people don't usually celebrate Christmas. So when I was a kid, I did try to take some of the things that I learned from school and bring it home. I did write letters to Santa. I just never got a response. And when I was little, I used to put out cookies and milk, thinking that Santa would come and that would, like, you know, bring me presents. But Santa never came, and my mom would get angry because she said, you know, leaving out cookies like that will attract ants. So she'll just, like, put it away. I would wait until midnight on Christmas Eve every night, hoping to hear reindeers and Santa come down the chimney. But they never came, and eventually I'd always fall asleep, wake up in the morning thinking there would be presents. But we would never have any presents under the tree. And then I thought it was because I didn't have a chimney, which is the reason why I never got any gifts. Maybe Santa just missed us this year, and then the next year, and the year after that. Now, when I'm with my fiancé and his family, we do celebrate Christmas. And my fiancé and I, we go pick out a Christmas tree every year and decorate it. And that's our little tradition. And we do exchange gifts on Christmas Day. But when I go home to my family, my parents, I think they want to celebrate Christmas, but they don't know how. And so they wait for us to come home and do something with them. And so what we usually do is we just cook a big dinner and we'll buy them like little gifts and try to bring Christmas to them in a way. But if I'm not at home that particular year for Christmas, then they just don't do anything.
We all have different ways to celebrate. And of course, many Christmas traditions involve food, including jars of peanuts. Tell us if you serve up something special for the holidays. Christmas curry chicken, maybe, or pierogies. We're at PRI.org. So time now for the second leg of my food crawl through the Boston area. We began earlier on the world, not far from our studios in Watertown, with some awesome Armenian food. Chicago-based food writer Steve Dolinsky took me next across the Charles River that separates Boston from Cambridge, where I live, and he schooled me in Boston's Brazilian history, as well as some great Brazilian food, at this place.
Here we are in front of Moqueca. Am I pronouncing that right?
Well, it's Moqueca, but I've seen it spelled with an O, Moqueca, but Moqueca. You can do it either way, Moqueca or Moqueca, and it's just a seafood stew is what it is.
Particularly to any part of Brazil or where?
Bahia, I think that's kind of the region I've heard that they came from, northeast, okay. But the interesting thing about this community in Cambridge where we are is most of the Brazilians came from this region called Governador Valadares. After World War II, a lot of U.S. engineers went down there, mining exploration. There were some railroads that were built, and apparently they brought the domestic workers back to Boston with them. And then in the 60s, ads were taken out in the newspapers down in São Paulo and Rio for domestic workers and maids. More people came to the area. There was also a soccer team that was started here with all imported Brazilian players. And then when people got here, they realized there was this established older Portuguese-speaking community already, so they just made this their home. People came here for education, to study, and it just grew and grew and grew, but everything kind of centered around Cambridge. And so it makes sense that there is this packed, I mean, this literally packed right now. I'm looking through the window, jam-packed.
Yeah, we're here on the sidewalk for a reason.
Yeah, we're out here because it's jammed inside. And but a lot of Brazilians, a lot of expats want to come here and get a taste of home, and it is basically a seafood stew with dende oil or coconut milk and peppers and vegetables. But it's basically seafood, dende oil, palm oil, and coconut milk.
We went inside the packed restaurant, took our seats, and placed our orders for the house specialty, moqueca. What else? The stew came out in these small terracotta pots.
All right, so I'm going to just serve you, but there is a lot of color here, which I like. There's a lot of shrimp and mussels as well. There's all these giant white onion rings. They're not fried. They're just sautéed. And there's just sort of stewed in this. I want to make sure I get some of the fish out here. So the fish is underneath, Marco. You're digging in too early. Okay, so we're going to place this all over the rice. Mussels, fish, vegetables. It's going to go on top of this mound of rice. And I'm going to take some of the juice. So the juice that the moqueca is cooked in is a little thinner than the side of fish broth they brought us. It's really thin. So, you know, again, I was expecting the palm oil, the dende oil, and the coconut milk. But because this is from the southern part of the region, in the Espírito Santo, there is no coconut milk. There is no dende oil. It's not going to be as rich.
It would dominate the taste.
It would be a lot richer tasting. Yeah. It would be thicker.
This is much more like a paella, almost. Mm. Flavor. I mean, it's really good.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's what it, well, it's basically a bouillabaisse.
Yeah,
it's like a fisherman's stew on top of white rice, which actually, by the way, is really good. The white rice is delicious.
Rice is
it's absorbing all the flavors here, but I want to put some more of this fish broth on top. But yeah, it's like a bouillabaisse, fish stew, not very thick broth, lots of vegetables.
It's kind of a revelation to be eating Brazilian food that isn't meat or black beans and rice, which I love. But this is just, it's like fish stew and complex and ingredients that I know of but never really tasted, especially together like this. Yeah, it's really amazing.
It takes a guy from Chicago to come to town to get you to come out here.
I mean, it's a little humiliating, but, I guess the lesson is I need to get out more.
Yes, I do need to get out more. Steve and I grab a sandwich Vietnam style later on the world as we make our final stop on this Boston food crawl. Given what day it is, how about some Christmas songs now from Guatemala? They come from singer and songwriter Gabby Moreno. For her new album, Posada, she returned to Christmas songs she grew up with in Guatemala. None other than Billboard magazine has called Posada, her album, an instant Latin Christmas classic. Gabby Moreno agreed to pick a few songs for us and talk about where they came from.
Pero mira cómo beben los peces en el río. Pero mira cómo beben por ver a Dios nacido. Beben y beben y vuelven a beber. Los peces en el río por ver a Dios nacer. Oh, oh, oh.
I used to sing this song, Peces en el Río, which means fish in the river, when I was a little girl during Mass on Sundays in December. I remember it being a very fun and cheerful song to sing. It was and still is one of the most popular Christmas songs in Latin America. It draws a contrast between the fish in the river, who are excited about the birth of the baby Jesus, and the Virgin Mary, who goes about doing the chores of daily life as an expectant mother. The writer of the song is unknown, although the tune shows some Middle Eastern influence. So for my own version, I decided to give it a flamenco and gypsy jazz twist. This next song is called Hacia Belén va una burra rin rin, which means to Bethlehem a donkey goes rin rin. This is originally a villancico, or Christmas carol, from Spain. Somehow it came all the way from Spain to Guatemala and settled there to be sung at church during Christmas.
Hacia Belén va una burra rin rin. Yo me remendaba, yo me remendé. Yo me eché un remiendo, yo me lo quité.
I sang with my church choir since I was 12 years old until I left Guatemala when I was 18. I remember eagerly awaiting the month of December to sing these songs. This particular one I enjoyed immensely. We would sing it at the end of Mass as people were exiting the church. It was only one organ and the choir. Nothing else was really needed. But for my record, it came to me the idea of trying the song in a huapango style, a style that comes from Veracruz in Mexico. Huapango and son jarocho are among my favorite styles that come from Mexico. So this is me giving a nod to that wonderful neighboring country of mine.
Lleva su chocolatera, rin rin. Yo me remendaba, yo me remendé. Yo me eché un remiendo, yo me lo quité. Su molinillo y su anaco. Ven acá corriendo, el chocolatillo se lo están comiendo. María, María, ven acá corriendo, el chocolatillo se lo están comiendo.
And with this song, I'd like to wish everyone Feliz Navidad, Merry Christmas.
Singer-songwriter Gabby Moreno telling us about her favorite Christmas tunes growing up in Guatemala. The album is called Posada.
En el portal de Belén, rin rin, yo me remendaba, yo me remendé, yo me eché un remiendo, yo me lo quité. Se han entrado los ratones.
You're listening to The World I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. So the last stop on my restaurant tour with food writer Steve Dolinsky was a place he wanted me to try in the Boston neighborhood of Dorchester. That advice, remember, don't eat everything. But when it's so good, what's a boy to do? And so I couldn't help myself because I love what this small Vietnamese sandwich shop serves, banh mi. The place is called Banh Mi Ba Le. As we drove there, Steve Dolinsky told me about the specialty.
Banh mi is just a sandwich. You know, we're going to basically a Vietnamese hero sandwich shop, if you will. Their version of a torpedo. But the typical one has got this pâté in the middle. Again, from that
almost
French...
Almost like liverwurst,
French,
yeah.
Liverwurst, exactly. Yeah. And there's going to be some chili, maybe a little spices in there, too. Coriander, cilantro.
What is the origin of banh mi? I mean, how did it start?
It was just a marriage of the sort of French colonialism and what they had on hand in Vietnam.
Mm.
And I think it's almost as ubiquitous as pho, the soup.
Yeah, right.
But it's just, you know, it's their version of a typical sandwich. But, you know, it's always going to have pickled daikon and carrots. It's always going to have a little sliced jalapeno. Always going to have fresh cilantro. And maybe a schmear of some kind of a mayo they have. But the rest is up for interpretation.
There were about 8 different interpretations on the menu at Banh Mi Ba Le, but the restaurant owner, Jennifer Nguyen, recommended the original, the number one. Steve explains.
The number one is their main sandwich. This is the sort of the Vietnamese classic. It's got that schmear of mayo and a schmear of the pâté.
Oh, you said hechi, but basically we're talking some kind of cold cut bologna.
Exactly. It's pressed pork. There's spices in there, but there's also a bologna that they steam and slice themselves. Yeah, they steam one, and there's a head cheese, and then also there's one that's got black peppercorns in it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to get all kinds of flavors going on. You're going to get the sort of that richness, but you're also going to get this bright, you know, the bright flavors from the pickled daikon and the cucumber. You're going to get that herbal cilantro. You're going to get the crispy crunchy in the outside of the bread. It's all going to happen to your mouth.
Jalapeno
is going to give you a little heat. It's all going to happen at one time.
Awesome.
All right, here we go.
Perfect.
It's perfect.
Well, aside from feeling a little full right now, Steve, I got to say, my brain is just completely sated as well. I mean, it's what a discovery today.
Yeah.
Armenia, Brazil, Vietnam, and they're all kind of like these trends running through the city that I live in.
It's amazing. I mean, I think about this all the time in Chicago because it's such an ethnic melting pot, but there is so much to explore here in Boston. And so the fact that I got you out of your little comfort zone and to go explore, and not only explore, but learn and taste new things, that gets me excited. So, I mean, I'm thrilled that you got to do that. I'm also thrilled that I got to eat with you, but it's so cool to be able to eat like this in America, in your own city.
Yeah, hashtag Global Nation, what can I tell you? A big thanks to Chicago-based food writer Steve Dolinsky for being my guide to Boston's ethnic food scene. So we're going to leave you today with some college boys. I've got our show producer for today's edition of The World, Andrea Crossan, to tell me more. What are you going to share with us, Andy?
Marco, I have to tell you about this group that I discovered recently. Now, I am a total sucker for a cappella. Give me some Glee, give me some Sing Out, throw me some Pitch Perfect. It's all great for me. So a couple weeks ago, a friend of mine was telling me about this amazing video that she saw. It's a group called Out of the Blue. And it's an all-male a cappella group, and they're from the University of Oxford in England.
Right, and Out of the Blue, these guys are pretty well-known on the a cappella scene. Not only are they great singers, but don't they do some pretty cool videos, too?
They do hilarious videos, and that's what's kind of become their thing. It's what's made them quite well-known. And in fact, earlier this year, they did a medley of Shakira songs, the Colombian singer Shakira. It was so good, this amazing medley that they did and the video that they did to it, that Shakira actually gave a shout out on her Facebook saying how fantastic she thought this version was. So here's just a little tiny chunk of the Shakira medley.
Shakira, Shakira. I never really knew that she could dance like this. She make a man want to speak Spanish. Como se llama? Bonita. Mi casa. Su casa.
Yeah, hips don't lie, and Out of the Blue, their lips don't lie. I'm sure they've done something really special for Christmas this year.
They have. They have got the most fantastic version of Mariah Carey's 1994, what I would say modern classic, Christmas Carol, which is All I Want for Christmas Is You. So they made this video. It took them about 3 days. If you're a fan of Harry Potter films, you'll recognize a lot of places in the video, including Bodleian Library, which is Hogwarts Library in the movies.
Yeah, so in these videos, the guys from Out of the Blue are walking around Oxford. They're singing. These videos are super campy. I mean, they're wearing their Oxford blue suits and ties and end up dancing and frolicking in Christmas sweaters. What's the deal with that?
It's kind of the deal with a cappella that it is really camp. It is really camp. And that's I did ask Hugh Braithwaite, one of the members of Out of the Blue, and I asked him about that kind of campy humor that they put into the videos.
It's sort of in line with the a cappella scene. We try and make it a little bit of fun. We try not to take ourselves too seriously when we do it, because we do get a lot of comments about the sort of camp nature of the videos. That's to be expected.
So this video has had huge success. It's had like 1.5 million views on YouTube. And also, just FYI, the money that they raise for the downloading of the song, it goes to a very good cause. It goes to a local charity in Oxford. It's a children's hospice where the guys regularly perform.
Andrea, thank you so much for this. Don't go away. We will go out today with the lads from Oxford University's Out of the Blue Glee Club singing Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You. But first, Andrea, it's Christmas. You're the show producer today, so we're going to say goodbye today your way. Our plucky Christmas staff is all here in the Nan and Bill Harris studios. Ready? We are
Nina Porzuki,
Aaron Schachter,
Andrea Crossan,
Shirin Jafari,
Steven Snyder,
Bradley Kahahambo,
Jonathan Keeling,
Max Rosenthal,
Tori Starr,
Matthew Bell,
Mike Wilkins,
and Marco Werman. Merry Christmas, everyone.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree.
I just want you for my own. All you could ever know. Make my wish come true.
All I want for Christmas.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the present.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. And by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Tagney Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.